GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Hello, I'm your host for GreenSense.
And this is Bob Kessler. I'm your executive producer.
We explore environmental issues, learn about sustainable innovations, and meet the passionate people that are changing the world.
But they got to make common sense and economic sense to get on our show.
And they got to tell us how they're good for the environment. Who will we meet this week?
Well, you know, we're going to delve into some issues with the California drought. You know, it's been raining a lot there. Doesn't mean it's over. We'll find out. Studebaker, one of the big auto manufacturers of the 20th century, been out of business for close to 50 years. Well, the factory where they were made is being repurposed into an innovation center in South Bend, Indiana. So we'll go there. And speaking of cars, Tom Appel of Consumer Guide Automotive will kick things off with Green Automotive News.
All that information in an informative and easy to understand way is coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel is first up on GreenSense with some green automotive news. Today, we're going to talk about hybrids, and we're going to talk about the Lexus, the 2017 RX 450H. I tell you, I don't know who names cars, but when they put so many Elfo characters in there, it gets very confusing. So maybe you could explain the naming of this car first, and then we can get into some of the details.
Actually, I can't because it makes almost no sense. The Lexus part, I think we all understand, and the RX is Lexus's midsize crossover. But 450 is sort of an exaggeration of the engine's displacement. It's a 350, and the H represents hybrid. But I think that Lexus believes that the hybrid makes it better, so they add 100 to it.
Good explanation, Tom. That's why you're the guru of gears. So tell us about the car. How do you like it, and why are we featuring it?
Yeah, we spent so much time lately talking about fuel cells and electric cars like the Chevy Bolt and the Chevy Volt and things like that. And I think that I don't want people to forget how good fundamental hybrids can be. And the Lexus RX is an especially good hybrid. Consumer Guide recently had time to spend a couple of weeks with the Lexus RX 450H and came away very impressed. And it was a great refresher on just how good hybrid the parent company of Lexus, I'm sorry, Toyota, the parent company of Lexus, can build hybrid cars. The RX 400H is powered by a regular V6 engine augmented by an electric motor, hence it's a hybrid. Very smooth. And the best part is that Consumer Guide and regular testing averaged 31 miles per gallon. That's a full 10 miles per gallon better than we saw with a strictly gasoline version of powered of the basic version of the car. But that said, it is refined. You can't tell it's a hybrid when you're driving it. Wonderfully refined cabin, quiet, smooth, easy to drive. It's everything that a midsize luxury car should be, except that it breaks 30 miles per gallon.
That's fantastic. So it has regenerative braking in it?
It does, and it's one of the smoothest regenerative systems in the industry.
All right, now let's get to a touchy issue, price. What's the price point on this?
Yes, and this is a great question. The Lexus RX 450H, well equipped, goes for about $57,000.
Ouch!
It's a lot of money for, I think, the regular consumer, but for someone looking for someone who has priced a midsize luxury crossover recently, that's a fairly reasonable price. We've recently driven a Cadillac XT5 that came in at about that price.
When you buy a car like this, are you making a green statement?
You are, and that's a great question, and it's a point I wanted to make. In the case of the Lexus RX 450H and a couple of other hybrids, you pay more upfront for the vehicle. And I think that people make a very bad calculus when they make these decisions and decide, well, I'm doing this for green reasons, which is a great reason to do it, but I'm going to lose money on the deal. In the case of the Lexus, for example, you pay about $8,000 more for the hybrid version of the vehicle than you do for the regular version. And so you're thinking that you have to offset that with gasoline savings, that you'll probably never do it. You save about $800 a year driving this vehicle on fuel if you drive 15,000 miles a year. But the point is, when you resell the vehicle, you're going to get that hybrid money back, or some of it. It's worth more money. So if you sell it when it's worth about half the price of the vehicle, you will only have to offset about $4,000. Additionally, the hybrid version of this car, and most hybrids, have more equipment, so you're offsetting an even smaller amount. Ultimately, in the case of the Lexus versus the hybrid versus the non-hybrid, you only have to offset about $2,500 if you include extra equipment and hybrid resale value, which you'll do in three and a half years.
Tom, a quick what you like and what don't you like about this car?
It is quiet, it is refined, it is very luxurious. That's the plus stuff. The downside is it isn't especially sporty. Most of the vehicles in this class are a little bit more fun to drive.
Anything else?
I like the resale value, and that's true of all Lexus vehicles.
That's Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel with our latest green automotive news. Is the California drought over? A year ago, only 5% of California was not under drought conditions. Earlier this month, heavy rains helped turn the number upside down, and now more than 90% of the state is drought-free. We're joined by Brian Fuchs, climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center, who can help explain what's happening. Welcome, Brian.
Hello, and glad to be here.
How unusual is it that drought conditions could turn so quickly in California? We go from 5% to 90% drought-free in a year.
Well, when we look at California, the winter season is really important, and that's when the majority of the precipitation comes. And last year, when we were looking at a very strong El Nino, we were hoping that that was going to be what really turned the tides of the drought in California. And actually, this season with the La Nina conditions is when we really saw those conditions rapidly turn and continually turning with ample moisture coming to the state.
Should we be relieved, or do you think it could change back to a drought condition as nearly as rapidly as we're in a non-drought condition?
I think we're in pretty good shape right now, and we should be relieved. With the wetter time of the year coming to an end here by the first part of April, we typically have a good idea of just how much precipitation we have seen as far as snow in the upper elevations and rain in the valleys. And with those numbers already coming in, many of them are already showing us being well ahead of where those seasonal peaks are. So conditions are really good right now in California, and I think many of the lingering impacts of the long-term drought are going to be subsiding.
Droughts impact aquifers, and the aquifer was fairly depleted. How can just one snowpack recharge an aquifer where that water takes a while to infiltrate?
Yeah, that is a very good question, and that's really the one that we're still focusing on. Of all the different impacts that we saw out in California during this drought episode, the depleted groundwater is really the one that we're still watching. There are still some reports of dry wells and some deeper level water that has not been replenished yet, and it does take time. So as we see that water in the surface waterways, the rivers and streams and reservoirs, it will percolate down to those deeper depths, and it just does take time. And realistically, that is the last impact that we're going to be watching, where all the other drought-related impacts have improved.
We've been getting news stories of the Sierra snowpack being far above average, as you've just mentioned. Why is it that that's important, and how does this help us going forward?
Well, in California, it is a very unique state that there is a great deal of water that's being moved from all over the western U.S. And so when we start storing that water for future use in the form of a snowpack in those upper elevations, the water managers do not have to deal with that water all at once, meaning that it will slowly melt off as we get into the late spring and early summer, and they'll be able to transfer that water then to areas that it's most needed and can be better utilized, versus if all that water came right now, it rained, and we had to deal with it in the reservoirs. And as we've seen in parts of California, when you get too much of that rain at one time, you do have issues with flooding. And that's, again, right on the heels of a very historic drought that we've seen.
Let's talk about agriculture. California is a big agricultural state, as well as some of the other Western states. When you get too little water or too much water, it impacts the crops. What are we seeing this year from this changing climate?
Well, what we're seeing is after several years of not having full deliveries of water for agriculture, meaning through irrigation, producers are going to be able to put the same number of crops back into their fields as they had 4 or 5 years ago, where over the last several years, they had left a lot of that ground fallow because they did not have water guaranteed to them for growing those crops. And when we think of the crops in California, many of them are in those fruits and vegetables that typically take a lot of water to begin with, and some of the nut crops and very specialized crops that are unique to California. So with the idea of having adequate water for irrigation and for growing all these crops again, most of the ag producers are going to be fairly well off this year as far as getting their crops in the ground and keeping them sustained throughout the entire growing season.
My guest is Brian Fuchs, climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. Brian, I was just out in the Imperial Valley and Yuma, Arizona, which is the winter lettuce capital for the U.S., uh-huh. And they were telling me that they're going to have a terrible season, that it got much too hot, then it was much too cold, and it was much too rainy. So leafy green prices are going to be up, and there's going to be a shortage. Have you heard about this?
No, I hadn't. But as you describe that, it does make sense for a crop like that, that you're looking, you know, they're planted in those areas because of typically the climate is stable. But you are right that earlier in the winter it was very warm, and then it was wet, and now you're getting into a different type of cycle as we get into spring, where things typically start getting hot down there as well. And I hadn't heard that, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I was also over by Lake Mead, so let's talk a little bit about the water levels that have been rising 14 feet since June and what that means to the western states' water usage.
Yeah, with both Lake Mead and Lake Powell, which are the two large reservoirs in the southwestern U.S., over the last 10 to 15 years, we have steadily seen those levels declining. And the pictures, especially from Lake Mead, of the big bathtub ring going all the way around the lake, and hearing the stories from Las Vegas that they have to keep moving their water intake pipes to just continue to get water. It has been a situation that has been in the forefront of many people's minds. And even, you know, you mentioned a 14-foot increase since June. When those levels have gone down over 100 feet over the last decade, it's good to see the improvement, but we would have to have many years in a row like this to continue to see that deficit in those reservoirs subside. So is it a positive? Yes. Is it going to be one of those situations where we see those reservoirs fill up the way they had been in the early part of the 2000s? Probably not going to see that happen this year.
Could all this news of the drought turning around and water levels rising be an excuse for people to think everything's okay, and now we don't have to employ water conservation techniques?
Yeah, and that's always fearful, that when you go into a drought, people tend to be very cognitive of what water resources are available and that they should be conserving. And sometimes when you have these wet years, like we're seeing here this winter, that people tend to lose that idea that, there's ample moisture and we don't need to conserve. But realistically, anywhere in the western U.S., especially as you get into the southwestern part of the U.S., water resources are definitely limited. And when you're bringing water in from hundreds, if not thousands of miles away to parts of Southern California, people need to be realistic in knowing that not only is the water resources limited, but the population continues to grow down there. So you have more people that are, again, putting an extra straws into that same cup of water than there was maybe 20 or 30 years ago. And there's still the need to always conserve.
If you were king for the day, what would be the one policy change you would do to help conservation of water?
Well, I think one thing that we can do realistically that is quite easily is if we went through all of our residences and put in the most water-efficient fixtures that we could use, low-flow toilets, low-flow shower heads, and learn from our neighbors down in Phoenix and Tucson and some of those areas that have really had to employ these out of necessity as these areas have continued to grow, you can conserve a lot of water just by having more efficient fixtures in everyone's houses, and that's going to save millions of gallons of water every year.
The term global weirding was introduced a few years ago instead of global warming, meaning that climate changes bring about all kinds of odd weather occurrences. Speak to this rapid fluctuation in water levels in California, and what does that mean for global weirding?
Well, I think it's a great example of just the extreme weather events that we are seeing more frequently as weather and climate have changed. Not only have we had some very warm years out in California, but we've went from some very wet years and some very dry years. So we've seen a whole gauntlet of conditions just in the last 4 or 5 years that in some instances have not occurred in this way in the last several decades. So the idea that people need to consider is, as we go forward, the idea of having more of these extreme events is likely, and we're probably going to be dealing with more flood events, we're probably going to be dealing with more drought events, and we're definitely going to be dealing with warmer weather conditions in the next few decades going forward.
That's Brian Fuchs, climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Many people alive today probably never have seen a Studebaker, much less know what one is. Well, it's an automobile manufacturer that made cars that are very iconic in South Bend, Indiana, from 1902 until the early 60s. When it went out of business, Studebaker left behind a brownfield sites in excess of 1 million square feet of property just south of downtown South Bend. Today, entrepreneur Kevin Smith is working on turning that brown dream into a green reality and turning it into an innovation center. Kevin joins us now on Green Sense, all the way from South Bend, Indiana. Well, believe it or not, Kevin, I first saw the old decrepit Studebaker facility when I was just a young geologist, and I started my career in 1987 doing a phase one site assessment at the property. And I remember walking the site, seeing this hulking remnant of an auto manufacturing plant. It looked like it was right out of a horror movie. You know, parts of the roof are gone. There was windows broken, pools of liquids with smelly chemical residue, broken machinery scattered everywhere. And it was the biggest site I'd ever visited at that time. For those of us who haven't been to South Bend, explain what the Studebaker facility looked like when you took it over.
The way I liken it is it's as if it had a heart attack and then that part of our community just simply died. And it was that quick. And everybody was out of a job, so it's like everybody just left it in mid-stride. And so accordingly, you know, it wasn't as maintained as one would expect. And so it had decayed, and it was the machine into the garden. So that's how I found it.
Architecturally speaking, does a site have good bones, and can you make it beautiful again?
Well, yes, absolutely. The great thing about it, the portion of the Studebaker campus that I purchased was the final assembly plant. It's where all the components came together and got assembled into the car. So it was engineered to be very heavy construction, 300 pounds of live load per foot. And it was the first, and it was a modern building in its time where it was poured in place concrete. And the concrete structure, it was notable then, and it is even gaining strength as it ages, concrete ages. So, yes, the bones are extremely solid and extremely well built. In fact, it's going to allow me to put a green roof on top of it because of the thickness of the material that they used.
Well, one of the things I loved when I was doing these phase one assessments at these old manufacturing facilities was finding things there. Have you found any cool, iconic remnants of the Studebaker facility?
Well, given the brevity of the discussion, yes. But if I were to pick just a few, the one was that we have dubbed it the cheese and cracker room. So when there was the Cold War going on, they actually brought provisions in there in case there was a fallout shelter. It became a huge fallout shelter. So that was kind of interesting because literally we had cheese and crackers from that era. So
oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a little unusual. The next really unusual piece, though, when I was putting in my parking lot, I discovered they had a unique way in 1940, evidently because of war, I'm not quite sure, they dismantled their their existing buildings built in late 1800s, and they stacked the bricks in the basement. So expecting dirt, I found 10-foot full of 10-foot full basements with bricks. That so that was a surprise that I could have done without. But it was interesting. You could see archaeologically how they built on top of other sites.
What's your vision for making it into an innovation center?
Well, the vision started in the 80s, frankly, when I renovated the Union Station into a technology center. So it's been a vision that has been formulating and in action for a good many decades. And so that's all I'm really doing is extending the success I had on that building. And it's going to be a technology center in a couple of ways. It's going to be for the people, but also for supercomputing, fiber optics. We converge some of the largest computing assets in, frankly, the Midwest. And then on top of it, what you do is you allow the people access and you make sure that the amenities allow for innovative people to come and use all the assets that's been collected over the last 30 years.
You're listening to Green Sense. My guest is Kevin Smith, and we're talking about his plans to convert the old Studebaker plant in South Bend into an innovation center. I'm Robert Colangelo. Well, Kevin, that's pretty ambitious, and one of the nice things about South Bend is there's numerous colleges out there that you can tap into, most notably Notre Dame. Besides this beautiful old set of buildings there, why did you pick South Bend for an innovation center?
Well, for a couple reasons. People have long forgotten that South Bend was an international leader in any number of fronts, not just Studebaker, but it was Singer Sewing Machine, South Bend Lathe, South Bend Range, Bendix, and the list goes on and on.
Why were so many industries there?
Yeah, as I did, they thought through it. It really came down to a couple things. One is transportation. We're on a major east-west thoroughfare, not only on just the road, but the trains, and so the train station played into it. But I believe more importantly is the intellectual capital that was imported, meaning that a lot of tool and die manufacturers or tool and die people came from Europe and landed in South Bend. Having that intellectual capabilities and skills to build machines, if you were going to build a manufacturing environment, we were a fantastic location because the people that built the machines, that built the cars in this case, or Bendix, were readily available. So we had those core resources that allowed innovation to prosper and spurt up.
I'm always amazed as I go through South Bend how many old industrial plants that you see out there. What about the people of South Bend? Are they supportive of the project?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons what keeps me going is I've been blessed with so many people coming up and literally people I just don't know. And they come and thank me and with the bottom of their hearts just saying that they are so happy that somebody's taking that Studebaker legacy, polishing it off and holding it back up as the appropriate icon it should be for South Bend.
Well, you've secured $22 million in financing as of last May. But it looks like to really do those three Studebaker buildings, you're going to need a budget of somewhere around $146 million. How's the financing coming along?
Well, we're already starting on phase two right now, and so there'll be another $12 million dedicated to this year alone, adding, we'll be putting on about 300,000 square feet of space, putting in productive use this year. So the good news is that after you get that core established, the rest of the mechanisms seem to snap into place much easier.
As far as population goes, South Bend's a fairly small town. How is it going to absorb all that space? And
it
what
won't
was
be
the
absorbed? Yeah, oh, it won't be absorbed by South Bend. It will be some of it, but a majority of the space will be absorbed from those coming from outside of South Bend to tap into the assets that we've assembled. For instance, I was one of the founders of InFocus, and InFocus has a fellowship from Notre Dame, and probably only 20% of the people that were in the program were from South Bend. The rest of them were from all over the world, and I can be proud to say that InFocus retained 80% of the fellows in the last 3 years. So it isn't so much repositioning people within South Bend, but creating an attraction to draw other innovative people from all over the country, if not world.
That's Kevin Smith, entrepreneur who's converting the Studebaker plant in South Bend into an innovation center. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to check out our show notes. You can read up on the project when you subscribe to GreenSense Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting GreenSense Farms. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. We have a question for you. What water conservation ideas or processes do you use? Send me an email to robert@greensenseshow.com. We'll be back next week with
Heroic Food. Where do they get that name from? Well, many of America's heroes are veterans, come home, and are facing joblessness. Well, Heroic Food, an organization in New York State, teaches them how to become farmers.
Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com. You can also view the list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal here is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. So stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at Green Sense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.